title for Psalm 17 I'm giving is Pray Without Ceasing. Pray Without Ceasing. Psalm 17. Prayer with confidence in final salvation, a prayer of David. Hear a just cause, O Lord. Attend to my cry. Give ear to my prayer, which is not from deceitful lips. Let my vindication come from your presence. Let your eyes look on the things that are upright. You have tested my heart. You have visited me in the night. You have tried me and have found nothing. I have purposed that my mouth shall not transgress. Concerning the works of men, by the word of your lips, I have kept away from the paths of the destroyer. Uphold my steps in your paths, that my footsteps may not slip. I have called upon you, for you will hear me, O God. Incline your ear to me and hear my speech. Show your marvelous loving kindness by your right hand. O you who save those who trust in you from those who rise up against them. Keep me as the apple of your eye. Hide me under the shadow of your wings. From the wicked who oppress me, from my deadly enemies who surround me. They have closed up their fat hearts. With their mouths they speak proudly. They have now surrounded us in our steps. They have set their eyes crouching down to the earth, as a lion is eager to tear his prey, and like a young lion lurking in secret places. Arise, O Lord, confront him, cast him down. Deliver my life from the wicked with your sword, with your hand from men, O Lord. From men of the world, who have their portion in this life, and whose belly you fill with your hidden treasure. They are satisfied with children and leave the rest of their possession for their babes. As for me, I will see your face in righteousness. I shall be satisfied when I awake in your likeness. By way of introduction to Psalm 17, there's a record of a gentleman named Charles Hodge, don't know if anyone's ever heard of him, who taught at Princeton Seminary. You know this story already then. Good. Back in the early 1800s. He was struck down at a very early age with a debilitating leg pain, and apparently the cause of which no one ever appeared to be able to get to the bottom of. He found himself needing to lay flat on his back for weeks and weeks on end. But such was his desire to keep working and teaching from the seminary that he used to teach classes at home, the first home working, from his sofa with his legs up in the air, apparently. Nothing could stop Charles Hodge from doing the work that he felt he must do. Does that accord with what you remember of him? Yeah. Oh, that's good news. Psalm 17 is much like this, with David constantly wanting to be about his work of prayer. So, this is a Psalm of David. Again, we read that at the beginning. Probably written at a very similar time to Psalm 7, if you cast your mind back. It's probably about a year. And that was when David had all of the Absalom trouble with Absalom pursuing him. Probably written at a similar time. You may have noticed that the title of this psalm is slightly different. Did you notice? Lots of the others say a psalm of David or a miktam of David. This is the first of five that is actually called a prayer of David. There's only five. The whole psalm is indeed a prayer, albeit not all direct petition to God. The psalm is split like this. There's only one slide, that's it. It's just so that you can keep a bit of focus on, as we go through, what the psalm is made up of. So as you can see, and as I said a minute ago, David keeps going back to petition. This is a good reminder on a prayer meeting night, eh? To go back to petition. David shows tenacity in pressing his needs and his requests upon God. He goes back to petition and back again. 1 Thessalonians 5, verses 16 to 18 say this: Rejoice always, pray without ceasing, hence the title, and in everything give thanks. I don't plan to go through the psalm verse by verse tonight. I'm going to try and highlight some key themes in the hope that that will be useful to us all. This is partly because lots of people who are way smarter than me struggle to interpret this psalm. And they agree that translating it perfectly from the original text is actually really quite tricky. And once again this evening, I give my thanks and my heavy reliance to Mr. Eveson and Mr. Dale Ralph Davis for lots of their thoughts on this. Always very helpful to me in the Psalms. Firstly then, pray without ceasing, in view of your integrity. Pray without ceasing, in view of your integrity. Now, to be clear, this is not at all suggesting that we can or should pray without ceasing because we are sinless or because we deserve anything from God. No, the point to be made here is that David claims steadfastness and consistency in his living, not sinlessness or perfection. So there's no need for anyone to panic right now with those words. Pray without ceasing in view of your integrity. David's not claiming to be sinless or perfect. In verse 1 then, David says, hear a righteous plea. Or to paraphrase, there's a few paraphrases as we go through tonight, if you'll let me. To paraphrase that, I beg you to hear me, God, because I'm asking for something good and something upright. David wants God to show him to be in the right. He wants to be vindicated. He wants God to vindicate his stand for him, for God. So having made that petition, David then goes on to make his argument, for want of a better word, for his integrity. Remembering when I say his argument for his integrity, that's his argument for his steadfastness in his life. David says three things to God. Firstly, you know I'm not a hypocrite. Secondly, you know I've watched my words. And thirdly, you know I have tried to walk the talk in front of everyone. I repeat again, there's no need for any of us to be jittery here. David isn't tooting his own horn there when he claims those things. David knows he can't stand under God's scrutiny. He's not claiming his own good. He's claiming that of God. But David can claim a genuine pursuit of holiness and a genuine attempt to please his God with his life. So, pray without ceasing in view of your integrity, not your sinlessness. Second point, pray without ceasing, in view of your emergency. Pray without ceasing in view of your emergency. So this takes us on towards verses 6 to 9 of Psalm 17. And we see David returning then to hard petition. So he starts with petition, he defends his integrity, and now he's back to petition again in verses 6 to 9, to real beckoning of God. First of all then, in these verses sort of 6 to 9, I draw your attention to what we can learn about Yahweh's character in these verses. In verse 6, what do we hear? We hear that God hears. We learn that God hears in verse 6. Well, I'm going to suggest this is fairly fundamental to us, right? To know this and to understand this and to believe this. Otherwise, why pray to a God who isn't listening, who isn't there to hear, or who doesn't want to hear? So this is fundamental to us, surely. We learn about Yahweh here, that God hears. Okay. And then in verse 7, we learn something else about Yahweh. I can't say it properly. Yahweh. Thank you. In verse 7, God repeats history. God repeats history. Now, I wonder if I hear any of you question, Daniel, repeats history? What do you mean? Where's that in verse 7? What do I mean? Well, Dale Ralph Davis would encourage us to read the first line of verse 7 like this. Make your acts of grace obvious. That's his paraphrase of the first line. Make your acts of grace obvious. He says this because of the original Hebrew text that I don't know anything about. Apparently, the original Hebrew verb here is used three times in the Exodus plague narrative. What's it used for there? It's used to make the distinction between the treatment of the Israelites here in some of those plagues and the treatment of the Egyptians there. Okay, so it's to make a distinction. It's the same verb that's used. So we could paraphrase David, therefore, as saying this. Show yourself again to be the Exodus God. Set me apart by making me the clear object of your special care. That's how we could paraphrase that part of verse 7. Make your acts of grace obvious. Stuart and I actually recently were looking at a similar theme as we've been going through the book of Daniel, and we've got to the really difficult chapters and stalled a little bit. There's a really similar theme in I think it's chapter 7 or 8, when Daniel prays that God would intervene. Stuart Olliott, in his book about it, writes this. I'm just going to read it, so forgive me looking down. The world around, talking about Daniel's time, the world around will form its estimate of God on the basis of the welfare of the people who are known to be God's people. I'll say that again. The world around will form its estimate of God on the basis of the welfare of the people who are known to be God's people. God then must act for his own sake. His own reputation and honour are at stake. If he does not step in to restore Israel, his name will be dragged through the mud. Similar theme here. Very similar theme. Verse 8 says the same in a slightly different way. David asks God to treat him like the apple of his eye. This is understood to mean the pupil, the very centre of your eye, one of the most sensitive parts of the entire body. I think we all know how sensitive that is. Some of you have had more particular operations on eyes than I have. It's bad enough when you get the puff of air in your eye at the opticians and you realise that it's a very sensitive part of your body, right? David is saying, treat me like that really sensitive, special part of our eye. Just like we have to be extra careful and extra protective of our eyes, David is asking God to do that with him. So this is all still under the point, pray without ceasing in view of your emergency. So from those verses of petition again, we come to verses 10 to 12, where David describes this enemy that's before him. These verses show us why this petition is so urgent. So remember that word emergency in the title of this point. This is why the petition is so urgent, because of what's going on immediately before David. David's enemy then in these verses, his own words, can be summarised as insolent, disrespectful and arrogant. That enemy's intent could be described as wanting to ruin David. The image that we read was that of a lion crouched down, ready to pounce on its prey. I think it's quite easy to read that without really letting that in, actually. Imagine how horrific and hard that must have been for David to actually feel that. He just felt like he had no out other than to cry out to God. And I think sometimes, I think it might have been Philip Eveson that made this point, actually. It's really hard sometimes when you read these psalms to enter into them, isn't it? Because we don't go through this. Have we ever been through exactly what David? I doubt it. I doubt we've been through exactly, or will ever go through exactly, the kind of situation he obviously finds himself in here. But it doesn't mean that we can't take the learning from it and apply it in our situation. There is an emergency here. David's need is urgent, and his petition reflects all of that. At the beginning of verse 13, I tried to read it with a little bit of impetus. Arise, O Lord, confront him, cast him down. So this verse 13 is like a crescendo to this this third part of the petition, this last part of the petition. Rise up, my promise-keeping God. Rise up, confront the evil ones. Lord, bring them down. So that's pray without ceasing in view of your emergency. Thirdly, finally, pray without ceasing, in view of your expectation. Pray without ceasing in view of your expectation. So verse 13 is the beginning of that third direct petition. I've already mentioned it, or the beginning of it. I don't know if you noticed, when I first read it, it kind of escaped me, actually. It seems like David actually has one particular person in view at this moment, doesn't it? In verse 13. He uses words like him, singular, and wicked in singular form in the original text. But then in verse 14, David seems to go back to plural enemies, and he lists out a few things that contrast with himself, with his character, and with his desires and wishes. So clearly it's more than one person, but perhaps when he's writing this, there is a real focus on one thing, that's one person that's really, really besetting him. So he lists out these things then, the contrast with himself. And then in verse 15, right at the end, we have a somewhat emphatic I, don't we? David says, I have a different hope to them, essentially. I have a different hope to them who surround me. Now, when I read verse 15, did you think, wow, that's a lovely way to think about death, I wonder? Read it again. I'm going to read it again. As for me, I will see your face in righteousness. I shall be satisfied when I awake in your likeness. Isn't that a lovely way to think about it? David was looking forward to seeing God, to awaking in his presence. I think most people agree that that phraseology there is about waking up after death and having his likeness again. Interesting then, isn't it, that yes, even in Old Testament times, faithful believers were looking forward to seeing God. They hadn't seen Jesus. They didn't have the whole Bible that we have. They didn't know that Saviour. And yet they were thinking about what comes after death. They were thinking about being resurrected. We learned on Sunday about the importance to remember the resurrection, perhaps more. They were already thinking about being resurrected. And they were absolutely assured, these Old Testament believers then in these times, were absolutely assured that there was, therefore, life beyond the grave. So yes, many Old Testament believers might not have had a carefully written catechism or carefully written doctrine all out, but they clearly anticipated a resurrection with their promise-keeping God that they knew and that they loved. So David's expectation then was that he would see God and be with him eventually, and it comforted him. So our 3 points were: pray without ceasing in view of your integrity, not sinlessness. Pray without ceasing in view of your emergency. And pray without ceasing in view of your expectation. So just to close up before we come to prayer. As with many things of David and David's life, there are parallels with the life of Jesus, aren't there? Who else looked to God alone to vindicate him when he was being falsely accused? Jesus. As I say, we heard about the importance of the resurrection from John last Sunday. This is how Jesus was ultimately vindicated for all of our good, right? Can I finish by reading a few words from Job 19? In my flesh I shall see God, whom I shall see for myself, and my eyes shall behold, and not another. How my heart yearns within me. May that be